This is Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. MSU President Luanna Simon and Athletic Director Mark Hollis are heard regularly on 870 AM's MSU Today. They recently had a conversation with Detroit Free Press writer Joe Rexroad about searching for compelling stories and the evolution of the sports reporter's world.
It has changed a lot. I would say even in the last 2 years, Twitter is a big part of that, but there used to be an off-season, and there really isn't an off-season anymore. We've talked about this a little bit, but really we need to have a story every day and the Free Press about our beat. In the sports department, we have, of course, six major beats, the Michigan State, Michigan, and the four Detroit pro teams. So we have a page two, and every day you have to have some kind of a story. So it used to be the month of May, maybe I would write 3-4 stories in the past, and now, it's you're trying to come up with something. You're reacting to things all the time on Twitter often. Mm-hmm. It's not like the internet's new. Something would come out in the past and it would find your way to you and you'd have to respond to it. But now it's like you better respond within the hour to something.
Yeah. Like a lot of people think they can be a coach. A lot of people think they can be a sports journalist. To be a coach, you have to have a team. To be a sports journalist, people can just pick up a computer and all of a sudden they're a competitor of yours. And I'm guessing that's created quite a challenge on your immediacy to get the news, to report the news, and yet stay on the fair side of it, stay on the balanced side of it.
It is, and a big problem with that would be anonymous sourcing, because there are a lot of things that if there were no restrictions that I could write or competitors of mine could write, say, well, I heard this, someone said this, and there are people out there who can use a source who maybe is a fringe source on something and will write it, and it may end up being true, but you can't, I at the Lansing State Journal, we had really a no unnamed sources policy for the last few years I was there, which I appreciated. Mm-hmm. At times it means you're going to lose on a story. Mm-hmm. you're gonna have to wait until it becomes official, but I think that I really have a problem with unnamed sourcing unless it's a really big deal, a really big story, and you have the best possible source or a very high level source, however you want to phrase it. And yes, there are people out there, like you said, who are competitors who don't have those restrictions, can do whatever they want to do, and that becomes a challenge. But sometimes you just have to be willing to lose. Yeah.
I think I come from the philosophy that, as Joe Kearney did, that we grew up as an industry in college sports because of the beat writers. The beat writers being there, understanding the inner workings, seeing the practices, seeing all that goes into play. And we have to check ourselves. There's occasions where, Joe will call me and we need to check and balance, and we'll assemble the troops. We'll bring together our beat writers. We'll bring together some of our staff, and we'll sit around the table and we'll talk about the threats that are out there of reporting. Mm-hmm. Fair and accurate news and things that we do and things that you do that are kind of creates new challenges, I guess, in the relationship because of people that are writing various stories that maybe have never met the coach, never met the player, student, athlete, kid, and yet feel that they're an equal expert as you who have seen it from the beginning.
And those are very helpful. Whenever we can get together, because it's important for us to understand where you're coming from too. I think it benefits both sides when the people who cover you are as informed as possible, even mm-hmm. with things that maybe they can't report. I've always found those to be helpful. We had one not that long ago,
right?
Over at Jenison.
Right. And
I think the more communication both ways, the better. And nothing. It's not going to go the other way. It's becoming faster, and there's more, mm-hmm. and that's fine. You just have to navigate through that and try to be fair.
I think from an administrator standpoint, there used to be a pace where an administrator found out about an issue, had the ability to manage it through the system, and come out with a good outcome. And in today's world, that window is so narrow because the news is immediate. In many cases, as an administrator, you're finding out about cases on Twitter,
A bulletin board,
and it, so it's put all of us on a is the information accurate? We're both asking that same question, and then how are you going to respond to that information once you pull it in?
Because one of the things about beat writers is the sense of context, and a sense that when you know people and how the programs are run, you have a sense about whether the needle is sort of pointing in the right direction. If you don't know anybody and you have no context except somebody puts up and says X on either through Twitter or on one of these message boards that people must have a lot more time in their life than I do.
As a consumer, you're asking yourself, it's on Twitter, so is it true? Is it true? Joe tweeted it.
Right.
So is it true? And I think you have to have a different barometer out in the public depending on where that information is coming from.
Well, that's a good point on context because, just for example, say like a football player transfers. Maybe if you've been covering the beat, maybe you know the depth chart situation or this particular person was homesick or whatever the case may be. You talk to a coach off the record and understand the situation. But if you're an outsider who has no sense of context, doesn't know what's going on, what's going on? Is there some problem? Is there some issue with this person? I mean, just for example, and I think people will sometimes jump to conclusions without understanding that. And I think your coaches have done a good job too of making sure that they do tell us some things off the record that can't be used, but it can help us understand what's going on a little better.
Well, I would use the example of the recent student who transferred from football. And one of the stories I saw on one of these clipping services that I'm a part of, only said that the kid was an X-star prospect. Okay, and then the story here put it in the context that while he was an X-star prospect, he wasn't an X-star player, as it turned out.
Right.
And as a result, he was really low in the depth chart after spring ball, and every kid wants to play. The fact base was the same. The kid is transferring.
Mm-hmm.
The one sort of uncontext, the story without a context, just said he was a great recruit.
Right.
And so it looked as if we had done something to drive away a great recruit.
Right.
And what we had was too many receivers.
Exactly.
And no, so I think that's really part of that, why it's so great that there are people, the free press, there are people like you who still believe in that beat writer philosophy.
Yeah, I think many examples. I think that's a great one.
Let me sort of, I know our listeners are interested in your take on Spartan football and basketball next season. So should we be smiling?
I think big picture, I think both programs are very strong. Obviously football team last year lost some close games, didn't have the season it wanted. It's tough for me to say. When I look at this football team, I think another very good defense. I think there are a lot of question marks about the offense. I think the schedule's favorable. I think there's a solid chance Michigan State is playing in Indianapolis. And at the same time, if Michigan State finished fourth in the Legends division, I wouldn't be that surprised. I think it's that close in that division. So I think it's going to be an interesting year. But I do think a lot of times it seems like you remember back to 2009, there were pretty high expectations for that team. Didn't have the season they wanted to have, went 6-6. No expectations the next year and really bounced back, won the Big Ten. Mm-hmm. And I think some of that is psychological. I believe in that stuff. I believe in maybe sometimes you get a little too high on your success, as maybe you could argue happened a year ago. Mm-hmm. And I think now there's a certain humility that was instilled last season. And I just wouldn't be surprised if Michigan State really came back strong and had a good 9-10 win season. Basketball, I think, the expectations are sky high on that end. And
a really tough schedule.
Yeah, really tough schedule in both non-conference and Big Ten.
We're trying to make it tougher every day.
Yeah, I'm sure. But even the Big Ten schedule, tough one. But it looks like I think one of Tom Izzo's best teams, and he's had a lot of good ones. But when you have that kind of athleticism, but coupled with experience, you don't see that all that often in college basketball anymore. So I think that team could do just about anything if everything came together, stayed healthy, and all those things.
Yep. And the season concludes down in Dallas, so it'll be an interesting Final Four in a lot of different aspects.
And you'll be there either way.
I'll be there either way. Hopefully we'll have the Spartans with us, which would be great.
Thank you, Joe, for being a part of the program, and thank you for being a part of Michigan State as an alum and for covering us so well.
That was Detroit Free Press writer Joe Rexrode. He spoke with MSU President Luanna Simon and Athletic Director Mark Hollis, heard regularly on 870 AM's MSU Today. On a block in Detroit's East English Village, Cheryl English's front yard sticks out like a green thumb. Her front yard and her backyard are gardening masterpieces, and many of the plants she grows are native to Michigan. She chose them not only because of their beauty, but because native plants are a crucial part of Michigan ecosystems and have many environmental benefits. Current State's Emmanuel Berry joined English in her garden, where she explained why people don't always appreciate native plants.
Our traditional garden choices are really driven by where we came from and not where we live. And by where we came from, I mean where the culture came from. And the culture basically came with, starting with Christopher Columbus in 1492, and what was the European invasion. And the European invasion included things like our livestock, our companion animals, our garden plants, our agricultural plants, our diseases, and just our cultural preconceptions of things, of how things should be. We came here to the Americas, and things were different. They weren't the way they were where we came from, and we set out to fix it because it wasn't right based on our experience and our context. And part of that had to do with the landscape, and the plants were not plants we recognized, and they interfered with what we were trying to do in terms of growing crops or what have you. What we have begun to learn recently, and it seems to be snowballing more and more, is that if we want to maintain the native populations of our songbirds, for example, or our pollinating insects like our monarch butterflies and our swallowtail butterflies, we need to have the native plants. And if we don't have them, we're going to lose that part of what we treasure here.
What are some of the other consequences of losing native plants, of not having native plants in gardens and spaces?
I don't know that we can even begin to understand what those consequences might be. I think about the first huge arboricultural disaster in the Americas, in North America, which was the chestnut blight coming in and devastating the American chestnut population. When Christopher Columbus landed in 1492, one out of every four trees in the eastern half of the U.S. was an American chestnut. And the chestnut blight wiped out 90% of them. We, in our ignorance, decided that the blight was going to kill every chestnut, so we clear-cut them out, not realizing that there might have been pockets of genetic resistance to this blight. And we have actually discovered remnant populations that have had a higher degree of resistance, and we are now working with those populations to come up with through breeding, a plant that can resist the blight. But when we lost the chestnut, we didn't even know what insects might be dependent on that tree, and we didn't even know what was out there. We don't even know what we lost when we lost that tree. We lost an entire chunk of our food web here, and we never even knew what it was. We make decisions with blinders on about our gardens, about our lives, without really realizing, and this is not a criticism, it's just a fact of human behavior, without really thinking about what the consequences might be on the wider environment. One of the things I share with groups that I speak to is the decisions we make on our gardens have consequences far beyond our fence lines. So as to what we're going to lose, if we continue to bring in indiscriminately exotic plants for agricultural or ornamental purposes, we continue to run the risk of bringing along diseases and pests which will continue to devastate our native plants, such as the anthracnose that devastates our dogwoods, the emerald ash borer, the Dutch elm disease. And we are going to end up, if we extend this to its logical conclusion, we will have a global ecosystem, which will be made up of a specific limited number of species. There will be extremely limited diversity. We will lose huge chunks of our insect life, probably most of our insect life, and huge chunks of every other part of our environment, part of the food web. We don't even know what we're going to lose. We haven't, can't even begin to capture, envision it, realize it.
So here in Michigan, Michigan native plants have, why are they better suited, I guess, to this environment and dealing with everything that Michigan weather and the state throws at it?
That's a great question, because a lot of people who grow up or spend the vast portion of their lives here don't realize, it doesn't even occur to them that we live in an environment with extreme weather. We can span 100 degrees Fahrenheit in 12 months here in Michigan, and that is not really the case anywhere else. You know, you don't get that in Florida. You don't get that in California, for sure. We have extreme weather, and the plants that evolved here, even though they may be the same species in other parts of the country, because there's, some of these plants have very wide ranges, they are specifically adapted, and they have some genetic distinctions from their cousins from elsewhere. They evolved here. They evolved to accommodate the soil conditions. They evolved to accommodate the climatic conditions. You know, we always have a drought in July and August. And there are plants that really languish in the drought, and a lot of them are exotics. And there are plants that laugh at a drought, like my cup plant, which is 9.5 feet tall when there's a drought and 10 feet when it isn't. One of the reasons I've keep doing more and more with natives is because I don't have to work as hard. And contrary to some people's perception, I actually find the natives much more beautiful because they're so varied. My maintenance in my garden every year is less and less as my natives thrive. I don't use any chemicals whatsoever, either fertilizers, you know, growth enhancers, or pesticides, you know, to suppress weeds or anything. I don't use any chemicals. I use no power tools. And I get to spend more time enjoying my garden and watching the hummingbirds and the butterflies and the goldfinches and hearing the spring peepers.
Well, we're in your big, beautiful garden, so let's take a look at a couple of native plants.
This is cup plant, and you can see it's got a lot of insect larvae, nymphs on there, and I've got a lot of people who are concerned about that. I don't know what they are, but I know that either if they're beneficial, that's, I don't care about it. And if they're not beneficial, a beneficial will come along to feed on them. So Mother Nature will keep everything in check. Cup plant is in the Silphium family. It's called Silphium perfoliatum. Perfoliatum refers to the fact that the stems, which are square in section, pierce the paired leaves. And the leaves are always arranged at 90 degrees to the pear below and above them. And the reason for this is that when it rains, the water spills like a big fountain down the plant. And that water that's cupped by the perforated leaves is then there for the larger insects to drink. It also traps younger insects to feed the plant. It also provides water for some of our birds as well. It gets small yellow flowers at the very top of the plant, and you get a lot of nectaring insects on there. You get a lot of birds feeding on the seed. You get squirrels jumping all over it like it's a jungle gym in August to get the seed as well. So this is a plant that really gives up a lot for the wildlife. And it's a plant that can shake off a drought. The roots go down way into the soil. So even if we have a severe drought, as we did in 2012, it just laughs it off.
All right, where to next?
The thing about native plants is you often can find a native equivalent to something that you're already growing in your garden that's an exotic traditional garden plant. For example, you have your oriental poppies. Well, we have what we call a celandine poppy, which is a spring flowering poppy with beautiful yellow flowers. We have one of the more popular summer garden plants is the lily family, our oriental and Asiatic lilies. But we have a lily here in Michigan. It's not just endemic to Michigan. It does live in other parts of the Midwest, but it is called the Michigan lily. And it's a beautiful Turk's cap type lily, brilliant deep orange, and the little stamens look like little ballet shoes hanging down. And it's an absolutely to die for plant. It's a spotlight wherever it grows. It can get up to 6 feet tall if it's happy. It does like wetter conditions. and it is an absolute showstopper. The plants that I have in my garden are actually plants that I inherited when my mother passed away. So aside from their value to me as native plants, they also have a very profound sentimental value, and I treasure them.
Are there any plants that are native to Michigan that people would be surprised are a native plant here?
I would say probably the most surprising plant in my garden that people are, they're always amazed that it's a native plant, is the prickly pear cactus. And it is a true cactus. It's a really interesting plant because when fall comes, the pads sort of deflate and they get very sad and they sort of repose on the ground and you pray for snow because it looks like a corpse and you want to cover it up. And then come spring, it just sort of re-inflates itself. It has these beautiful yellow flowers with orange throats that last, each flower lasts less than a day. And it's really something special, really special.
Yeah, I never would have thought that Michigan has cactuses. That's for sure. So in gardening, there's kind of an entire industry, magazines built off of, as you mentioned, you know, what's new in this philosophy, what's hot, what's coming out. Do you think there needs to be a kind of a paradigm shift in the way people think about gardening?
I think we're going to be seeing a paradigm shift. I know of people who have canceled subscriptions to gardening magazines because they don't carry information on natives. I am seeing more awareness of natives. I do realize that my perspective is rather parochial, you know, informed by my own experiences and my own interests and values. But I think that that is becoming more part of the general consciousness. More people are asking questions and wondering, well, what's the difference? There are a lot of preconceptions about native plants that I fight with. Even when I was working with the Greening of Detroit on their trees committee and we were selecting plants for our tree sale, and I was always the proponent for including some natives, and the response I always got is, well, no one knows what to do with them. And my response to that is, isn't that part of our mission is to educate people about these things? And when you start talking to folks about, well, if you grow common milkweed, you'll get monarch butterflies, and if you grow spice bush, you could get spice bush swallowtail butterfly, and if you grow this plant, you'll get this butterfly. It's really amazing. The eyes light up. People are beginning to realize that the environment has changed. They are seeing fewer butterflies. They are seeing fewer of the big bumblebees. They're seeing fewer blue jays or cardinals. And they're not happy about that. And if we want to repair that damage, or at least stop the trend, if we can't reverse it, at least stop it, native plants are critical to accomplishing that end.
Cheryl English is a master gardener. She lives and gardens in Detroit's East English Village. Cheryl, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Up next on Current State, some of the thrilling sounds of yesteryear as Peter Wharf tours a vintage radio collection, and Greening of the Great Lakes' Dr. Kirk Heinze returns to the garden with MSU Horticulture Extension educator Mary Wilson. Stay with us. It's Current State. This is Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Lansing-based Michigan Antique Radio Club advocates the preservation of the history and knowledge of radio, television, and related disciplines, with a special emphasis on contributions originating in the state of Michigan. The club recently held its annual expo. Mark Oppitt handles publicity for the organization. He's an avid radio collector and runs his own online radio parts supply company. WKAR's Peter Wharf recently visited Mark's Plymouth, Michigan home for a look at Oppitt's radio collection and a discussion of how he got into vintage radios.
definitely by the time I was 15, I was into old radios and electronics. But by the time I got into high school, I took electronics class the first year I was in high school. And within a couple months, I was already repairing antique radios.
Tell me about some of those early memories of radios that you saw. What are the first things that turned you on, listening to them, seeing them, getting inside of them?
Well, it was a lot of fun at first, of course, because it's all new discovery, you know. You think of, at that time, I was thinking of the 1920s being ancient history because I was 16 years old. So, you know, I would see something and think, oh, my God, this is from, you know, many, many years ago. It's just a lot of fun to look at them and discover things. There were a lot of brands I'd never heard of before, like Atwater Kent or Crosley or these names that had disappeared. And every time I found one, it was like, you know, opening, you know, King Tut's tomb. You know, it was just a lot of fun.
Well, Mark, we just met over the phone a couple of days ago, and you very kindly invited me to your home here in Plymouth. Mm-hmm. And when I walked in, I just muttered to myself, wow, mm-hmm. you have hundreds of old-time radios.
I wouldn't say hundreds, but I have a lot.
Dozens, scores, yeah, at least.
Yeah. I'm actually not one of the largest collectors in the club. There's people in the club that'll make me look like a piker.
Well, it's impressive. Can you show me a little bit of your collection and talk mm-hmm. about some of the radios, mm-hmm. the models, the years, and that sort of thing?
Well, radio collecting encompasses quite a wide range of things. It can be table radios, it can be consoles, and in both of those fields, well, in the table radios, there's quite a wide variety of materials that they were made from. As you can imagine, the cabinets range from the earliest plastic, which was called Bakelite. And that was invented in 1909. Radios basically came out in 1920, so the earliest radios had wood boxes with a Bakelite panel on the front and a flip-top lid so you could get at the tubes and everything, and they were battery-powered, and you would hook them up to either a set of headphones or a horn speaker. They were very primitive.
At the present time, Harding has collected more than 16 million votes against some 9 million for the Democrats. We'll give you the state vote in just a moment. But first, we'd like to ask you to let us know if this broadcast is reaching you. Please drop us a card, address station KDKA, Westinghouse, East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Talk to me about this group of Zenith radios mm-hmm. here on your shelf. Mm-hmm. These look like all the same model, but all different colors. Are these plastic or Bakelite?
They are some kind of a plastic from the 50s. That's a 1954 era model that you're looking at.
Zenith.
Yes. And those that was a time, as you know, in the 50s when colors exploded in the home. Right. And colors on cars started to become more vibrant. So it was an exciting time.
So you have black, white, turquoise, maroon,
yes.
green,
yep.
red, and pink.
Salmon. You missed
salmon.
Salmon is the fun color there. You really don't see, you know, whenever you see a color like salmon, I think I got that one fairly early on. And when you see a color salmon in a radio line, you got to go, well, there's got to be a lot more than this, because they went through all the other stuff before they got to salmon, you know.
What's this up above the Zeniths? That's mm-hmm. a different model. It says Sentinel, I think. Is that Bakelite?
No, antique dealers call it Bakelite. They call everything Bakelite. But radio collectors delineate between specific plastics. And that plastic is something that's very cherished by collectors, called Catalin.
It has a sort of a creamy, almost a pearl-like look.
The color looks like a pumpkin color there. Yeah. And believe it or not, but that was originally ivory when it was made. Oh. It ages to that color.
Really?
Yes, yes. And here, I'll turn it over for you.
Yeah.
If you look on the bottom of these radios, you'll see that they're yellow.
Oh, yeah.
And that's even not the original color.
Sure.
So
the color changes with light and
it oxidizes.
These are some of the tabletops that we're looking at right now. Now, would these be considered tombstones?
Yeah, those are. Yeah, these tall wood radios are what we call tombstones. They're pretty much any radio that stands taller than it is wide. Is called a tombstone, if it has a flat top, or a somewhat flat top.
And what are these two beauties we're looking at here?
This one's a Crosley 10-tube, which is the top of the line for that year. So it's their deluxe model, fairly hard to find. And what's kind of neat about this one, I actually found this in one of the booths at one of the radio shows. I happened to be in Chicago, and it was all beat up, and somebody had turned the taken the chassis out and turned it around. And so nobody really looked at what a great radio it was somehow. And it had been beat up so bad, it had a hole in the face of the cabinet here. I had this cabinet restored. Can you see where the hole is? Or was?
I have no idea. No, I can't.
Right there. There was about a quarter inch by 1 inch size gash right in the face.
It just looks like a pattern in the wood or sort of a knot that basically matches the other side.
It's been blended in perfectly, and you'd never know it was there.
Beautiful.
And in fact, what there's kind of a secret with some cabinet finishers. You know what they use sometimes? Bondo. car putty. And if you get, I think there's a couple of different colors of it, but it will take stain, and it'll look just like wood. This one's very rare.
I've never seen anything like this.
Yeah, this one's extremely rare in that, it has another feature that radio collectors love, which is the tuning eye. And this will light up green when the radio comes on.
Wait a minute, something's happening. Some shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from that mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Ah! The whole field's caught up by the woods, the fires, the gas tanks of the automobiles spreading everywhere. It's coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
It's got a beautiful dial and a beautiful grill, too, sort of a glockenspiel or lyre look.
Yeah, like harp. You're right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. And I don't have a whole lot of radios with a lot of fancy grill work, but they made, you know, a lot of stuff back then that was really outrageous.
It's very beautiful. Would you show me a few more of your more prized items?
Well, here, let's actually turn one on. This is a Spartan. This was made in Jackson, Michigan.
Right.
And you'll notice the name is spelled Sparton.
Yes.
And that's because it is the Sparks Worthington Company. So it's not Spartan out of, the team
MSU,
from
right?
MSU, right.
Here it comes.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your support.
Groups opposed to same-sex marriage upset. Thomas Peters of the National Organization for Marriage.
When it comes to the issue of...
That's great.
Isn't that cool?
That's the Spartan, and this is a full-size
console. We call them consoles or floor models.
Floor model, right.
Right.
What other things are hardcore radio fans into that sort of the average person like me wouldn't be aware of, but... would be interested in knowing.
They do like colorful dials, so that's, and you know, like this one is backlit here.
Yes.
You can see it is in like orange and red and green and yellow. So those are, that's a sexy feature.
Very.
Any other extra cool trim stuff on a radio, like this curtain effect on the wood on the corner, that's kind of neat.
I'm speaking with Mark Oppett today in Plymouth, Michigan. He's involved with publicity for the Michigan Antique Radio Club.
Just like Antiques Roadshow, we've had some amazing things walk in the door. And
what sorts of things?
Well, the last year we had probably the most amazing thing of all, which was one of the two Holy Grail radios of all time.
We were talking about this on the phone the other day, and this is one of the things that you just... sort of live to see.
Exactly. There are two radios that have ever sold over $50,000 in good condition.
Wow.
And this is one of them. This radio was found in a barn north of Lansing by a woman who actually knew it was there because her father had bought it at an auction. And her mother was getting up in age, and she was going through her mother's things because her mother was going to be moving. So she goes out in the barn and knows the radio is there, but she knows nothing about it. And it had been put out there 10 years ago with a tarp over it. Well, unfortunately, the barn had a lot of gaps in it, and the tarp had blown off, and the thing had gotten very weathered. Still, she looks at this thing, takes a picture of it, goes online, tries to figure out what it is. And her jaw drops when she sees that this radio she has appears to be matching something that she sees online that sold for over $50,000.
This was the Spartan Nocturne.
Yes, the Spartan Nocturne, exactly. Mm. It's a famous radio in radio collecting. It stands about 3 feet high. It's a blue mirror that's about 3 foot diameter. The radio is in a wood box behind the blue mirror, and the knobs and shafts and things come out through the mirror. And on the face you see chrome strips. And it is Art Deco to the max.
Think of a Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers dance scene, and this would be the radio.
In a grand ballroom, in a hotel, in Miami, okay? That's the as far as you can go for Art Deco. Let me show you a picture of it. I've got one here. This is the exact radio as it was presented at our auction. You can see on the face the chrome is all rusted.
Yeah.
But it's all there.
Oh, that's the actual radio.
That's the actual radio. Here's a picture of one of our club members hauling it with a hand truck. And this was brought to our auction last year. She called us in advance, luckily, and told us that she had it. And our club members went out and got it, brought it into the show, and we had it listed in our auction listing, so it got good publicity. Collectors came from all over the country to bid on it. It sold for $34,000. Yes. Even missing a knob.
Mark Oppitt is involved with the Michigan Antique Radio Club. Mark, thanks so much for the time and the tour.
You're welcome. Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Wolf.
The Great Lakes is a regular feature on 870 AM's MSU Today, where host Dr. Kirk Heinze recently interviewed MSU Horticulture Extension Educator Mary Wilson.
Mary is an MSU Extension Horticulture Educator. She's also the project leader for the Master Gardener Program. Mary, great to see you. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kirk. I'm glad to be here. Well, the program starts off with a 14-week training. All different topics of horticulture, from the various, you know, plant science, soil science, integrated pest management, and each of the various areas of horticulture. And each week, the participants participate in a 4-hour session, and they are taught by university specialists. Mm-hmm. And so they get, you know, the latest and the greatest information on the various topics.
Are these programs offered virtually in every county, or are they more regional?
They're actually located in various, right now it's kind of primarily strong population areas right now, but we are expanding it in different areas and also looking into using distance technology and ultimately online classes probably in the next year or two.
Well, what kind of people do you look for in a master gardener?
I want to dispel the rumor that people think that you have to know a lot about gardening to take the class, and you don't. You just need to have an interest in gardening, maybe an interest in being outside, and sharing what you learn with others, because that is a part of the Master Gardener program, because you learn in classes, and then you take this information out to people throughout your community and share the knowledge that you've learned in classes.
Well, one thing about MSU Extension, there's always been this mantra of training the trainer. So this
Absolutely.
Is a paradigm example of training the trainer. So a person becomes a master gardener. And what do you have to do? I mean, besides taking the courses, don't you have to pass some kind of a certification examination as well?
Yes. And that sometimes intimidates people, but it's really not difficult. And yes, there are weekly quizzes just to kind of test to make sure that you're on track. And then we have a final exam. And you know what, Kirk? These are all open book. So we don't want to intimidate too many people like this. But yes, so then you take the class and you pass the quizzes and the final. And then you participate in 40 volunteer hours in your community, again, sharing what you've learned in class and educating others. Again, extending the university out into the community. And then once those two components are completed, you become a certified Master Gardener volunteer.
Okay, so you've got this base level of training and you've become a Master Gardener and you've done all of this great horticultural coursework with MSU Extension Specialists in Horticulture. But there are also opportunities for some advanced training, I think, for people who've already been through the basic course.
Absolutely. There are various programs that we put on throughout the state, but also once a year we have what we call Master Gardener College, and that's our annual conference. And if you can imagine, Kurt, all the Master Gardeners from around the state come together, they congregate at Michigan State University, and we have all kinds of sessions on specific topics that Master Gardeners are interested in. And so it's basically an ongoing learning process in gardening, and again, just an opportunity to get together with other people that share a similar interest is just so exciting to a lot of people.
Well, this year it's going to be June 21st and 22nd at Michigan State University. Do you still have some openings, or is it past registration time?
We are still taking openings, and it is for Master Gardeners, though. Mm-hmm. So people that have gone through the training and completed their certification. Yes, absolutely. We'd love to have all Master Gardeners from around the state come and join us.
Any highlights for this year's program at the college?
Oh, yes. We have Dr. Jeff Gilman from the University of Minnesota coming in, and he's going to be talking about, kind of debunking all these horticulture myths with science. And that's the thing. You know, there are lots of gardening programs available to people, but what we really are unique about in terms of what sets us apart is that our program is based on research. Okay, so Dr. Gilman is coming in. He's going to talk about debunking, all these gardening myths. He's going to talk about the truth of organic gardening. And then we also have our meteorologist, Dr. Jeff Andreessen, talking about climate change. And what does that mean
on this program.
Yes, what does that mean to gardeners?
I'm talking with Mary Wilson, who is the project leader for MSU Extension's Master Gardener Program. Mary, approximately how many people are Master Gardeners in the great state of Michigan?
Well, we have about just a little under 4,000 active Master Gardeners.
4,000, wow.
Yeah, so pretty amazing. And from the UP all the way down to Monroe County and Berrien County, so across the state.
Well, in addition to the Master Gardener College that's coming up, you mentioned international earlier in this interview, but there are even international opportunities for these folks.
Yes, and when I say international, the program is based primarily in the United States, mm-hmm. but all the states in the country have the program. Also Canada and Korea. A recent addition, and I believe Russia, but I'm not positive.
So it's starting to spread around. This good news is spreading around the
globe.
Oh,
it's a great program, Kurt, and it makes individuals feel good to engage in gardening, and there's so many community benefits that Master Gardeners have been involved with through their various volunteer projects. It's incredible.
Well, Mary, in addition to your work with the Master Gardener Program, you are an MSU Extension horticulture educator, and you and your colleagues have put together a lot of information available on the web. You call them smart gardening resources. What are some of those resources that people can access, whether they want to be in the Master Gardener Program or not?
Yes. Well, we have three primary areas that we're focusing on, and that's smart soils, smart plants, and smart lawns. And the resources, we have a lot of tip sheets that are available right on the Gardening in Michigan website. So if people just are on the internet and search for Gardening in Michigan, that will pop right up. And you go right to that website, and right on the home page, we have a section on smart gardening, and we have videos as well as tip sheets. Mm-hmm. So people can learn about, you know, you don't need to necessarily rake up all those leaves on your lawn. You can actually mulch them into your lawn. You save time, and you're actually adding nutrients to the lawn. And what's really interesting is there's MSU research to prove that also by mulching your leaves into your soil, you can also reduce your weed problems. And things like raising your mowing height and reducing the amount of pesticide you have to put on your lawn. You just have a healthier turf. So there's some really smart gardening tips that we share in our fact sheets.
Well, you talked a little bit about lawn. Are there two or three things when it comes to flowers or vegetables that you can share with our listeners?
Well,
commonly asked questions?
Well, one of the things, and I'll go back to our smart gardening focus areas, would be the smart soils and to make sure you get your soil tested. Mm. And that's always
absolutely
good. And it's also a good idea not only for growing healthy plants, but it also is good for our environment to make sure you don't put down too many nutrients, and especially phosphorus, because phosphorus can damage our water quality.
Yeah.
For plants, one of the focus areas is we're focusing on native plants and plants that have lower input but yet still provide the beauty to our home gardens and our community gardens as well.
Mary, one question that a lot of listeners have, and this is one over your career since you were a student at Michigan State to now, the interest in organic gardening, has that grown? Has it stabilized? Where is that compared to what may be called more conventional gardening?
Well, there is a lot of interest in organic gardening, and I think, you know, it's not only organic gardening, because sometimes people don't fully understand what organic gardening is, but one of the things that, in fact, we have always promoted is least toxic pesticides.
Right.
Mm-hmm. and using other practices besides pesticides, because you can use maybe cultural practices. You can use, there are biological control products that you can use that are much safer for the environment. So, yes, I think everybody is more environmentally conscious, and it's just a really important gardening strategy that we try to promote.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes host Dr. Kirk Heinze with MSU Horticulture Extension educator Mary Wilson. Greening of the Great Lakes is a regular feature on 870 AM's MSU Today. That's Current State for today. Our producers are Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, Kevin Lavery, and Scott Pohl. Peter Worf is executive producer. Our show is engineered by Aaron Young. Current State's producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State.